gave it to you already.
I know.
The next matter on the calendar is State versus Vang. As counsel are getting situated, welcome to the Court of Appeals. My name is John Rodenberg. With me are Judges Bjorkman and Reyes. You can be seated. The second matter on our calendar, as noted, is State versus Vang. You will each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. As you approach the podium, give us your name and the party you represent so that we've got that for the recording. I think you're both familiar enough that I don't need to say much more than that. And whenever appellant is ready, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Workman. I'm an assistant public defender, and I represent the appellant, Lee Vang. Your Honors, Ms. Vang was a passenger in a car with her boyfriend, Mr. Stone, when it was boxed in by bounty hunters who were looking for her boyfriend. Ms. Vang was cooperative with the bounty hunters and told them about the drugs in the bag found somewhere behind the driver's seat in the car. Her boyfriend's cell phone was found in that bag.
By the time the police got there, the drugs were no longer in the location where they allegedly had been.
That's right.
They were sitting on the hood of another car.
That's right. It had been taken out and put on the hood of the car by the bounty hunter. You're correct, Your Honor. Ms. Vang was released by police at the scene as well. She was charged 5 months later with 2 counts of possession of methamphetamine. Count one charged that she jointly and constructively possessed the drugs. And count two charged she aided and abetted her boyfriend's possession. The evidence was insufficient to prove both of these counts, and we ask this court to reverse and vacate these convictions. Regarding the first count, which is our first issue in the brief, the state relied on a theory of joint constructive possession in that count. The state had to prove that Ms. Vang knowingly exercised dominion and control over the methamphetamine. The state failed to do so here. While the state may have proved proximity and knowledge, that is not enough. They have to prove more than that. They have to prove the exercise of dominion and control. Now,
but
how
doesn't the fact that this was her car or her father's car and her relationship with Stone get us or constitute sufficient evidence of that something more?
I'm glad that you asked that question, Judge Bjorkman, because that gets into what I'd like to talk about, which is the facts that underpin what makes dominion and control. Your Honor, you have to look to the circumstances that are proven to determine if there's dominion and control, and those circumstances are not here, including the fact that this was her father's car and that she was with Mr. Stone. The things that help you...
I just want to clarify. Are you saying those are not circumstances proved?
Proved, but they are not enough to prove dominion and control, Your Honor.
Right, but those aren't the only circumstances that are proved.
That is correct, Your Honor, and I'll go through them all if you would like for me to. The things that help this court determine dominion and control are things such as personal items with the prohibited item, actions of the defendant, DNA, fingerprints, statements of the defendant. These are all things that have been said many times over and over by this court as well as the Supreme Court to equal dominion and control.
Right, but that's not an exclusive list, though.
That's not, but what we have here, that list is a good indication of the things that you should look for.
Go ahead.
What we have here is not enough. And to your point, Judge Bjorkman, about the car being the father's, what we're looking here for is consciousness of guilt. The fact that she used her father's car is not consciousness of guilt that she's possessing drugs.
She possesses the car in which the drugs are found, and she's possessing, it was available to her regular use. That's part of the circumstances proved, correct?
That is correct, and that is something that was stipulated too.
And the parties, the two people, left the building together 2 a.m. in the morning, which is a little bit of an unusual time, right?
I think what's more telling here, Your Honor, is what she did not do. What we see as a prime example of dominion and control in other cases that we're lacking here. What we see there in other cases are an attempt to flee or trying to mess with the bag or trying to hide the drugs, lying about the drugs. None of that is here. We don't have her touching them.
I agree with you, and that seems to be the arguments that were advanced in defense of this case. But when we're looking on appeal, at the circumstances proved, don't we have to start from the proposition of looking at the circumstances that support the guilty verdict and really setting aside all of the stuff that doesn't? And I agree with you. We don't have a lot of other indicia here. She didn't have articles found in the bag with the drugs, things like that. But that's not how we analyze these cases on appeal, is it?
You're correct that it is a deferential standard to the state and to the circumstances proved and to the jury's verdict. You are correct there. But however, you have to remember that the standard also includes that if there is any reasonable hypothesis of innocence, then that controls.
So to explain that to me, from the circumstances proved, what are the other reasonable inferences other than guilt?
That she was just hanging out with her boyfriend. Maybe she knew that he had the drugs, but she had no control over those drugs. They were solely his.
Well, but weren't the drugs within arm's reach of her?
Access is merely one thing to look here for.
It's certainly only one, but that seems to be a circumstance proved. They left together from the building together. The drugs were in a car that belonged to her father. They both got into the car. They were stopped. He was taken out of the car. The drugs were in a bag behind his seat, accessible to her, right?
That's correct.
And she told them there's a bag with drugs. And in fact, they even asked, when asked about weapons, and then she said, and it's not a small amount. So not only did she know there are drugs in there, but she knew the amount.
That's correct.
The amount. So and she knew that there's a cell phone in there, and then asked if she could have that cell phone.
That's right. So as to the cell phone point, Your Honor, as I'm sure you know, the pervasiveness of cell phones and the amount of private data we carry around in cell phones in the society nowadays, asking for that cell phone is really more akin to like asking for somebody's wallet or something just to hold on to it for safekeeping.
Well, that's not one interpretation, but we're looking at this. Well, go ahead.
It's not indicative of dominion and control for this reason. What you're pointing to here, Judge Reyes, is mere proximity, and access.
Proximity.
It's access, it's proximity, but it is not dominion and control. And if you look at the Harris case, that case has worse facts than here, and yet the Supreme Court overturned that. There, Mr. Harris was the driver. He was in a car with other people. His DNA could not be excluded from the handle of the gun that was found that he had access to.
But it was a concealed weapon, right?
And yet this was these drugs were concealed in a bag
as
well.
Not to your client, they weren't. She was the one who told the officers what was in the bag and that it wasn't a small amount and
that,
where it
which
was.
Shows knowledge, but it does not show dominion and control.
I think what we may be asking is, in Harris, was it conceded that the appellant was even aware of the existence of the gun up there? I kind of remember that maybe he wasn't.
That was an issue that was litigated, whether he knew or not.
Right.
Regarding Harris, though, what it comes down to is an interpretation of dominion and control that says we need more than just mere access. And that's what I'm getting at here. We need more than just mere access. We need more than knowledge. We need some actions here. We need circumstances proving that she not only knew, but she was controlling those drugs. And that is not what we have here. And, Your Honors, I'd like to move on to count two.
But keep in mind, we're not talking, this is joint possession.
That's right.
It's not sole possession. Your argument seems to be that she was the one who was solely controlling possession.
If I implied that, that's not what I meant to imply, Your
right,
Honor.
She can jointly, and it seems that
that's
two of
right.
them being together at that time of day in the car with those and her very thorough knowledge of what was in there, It's hard to, well, let me ask you this. Would you agree that the circumstances proved show that at least one reasonable inference is that she had joint possession and control of the drugs?
perhaps there is one reasonable inference, but a reasonable hypothesis of innocence still remains. And that means that...
That certainly is one.
And because a reasonable hypothesis of innocence remains, the standard is that Your Honors must reverse.
Right. And what? How do you interpret those circumstances proved to show that she did not have joint possession control? Based on those circumstances proved...
That she was in the car, that she's with her boyfriend, who is the person who is being looked for by bounty hunters, by confessing and telling telling straight out to the bounty hunters what was in there. That actually shows the opposite, that she had no control over it. Somebody who's wanting to hide their influence and their... participation in a crime is not going to just say, oh, yeah, there's a lot of drugs in there. That's not how this works. And I think Your Honors have seen enough criminal cases come before you where you've seen the difference here.
So if speaking of participation, why don't we go to the next one, the aiding and abetting.
Aiding and abetting, yes. So, Your Honors, to be guilty under the aiding and abetting statute, the state has to show that Ms. Vang knew her alleged accomplice, which was Mr. Stone, was going to commit a crime, and that she intended for her presence and her actions to further the commission of that crime. Now, what we have to focus on here really is that she intended for her presence to further the crime. Regarding her father's car here, then, she would have to use her presence in that car to aid Mr. Stone, and we do not have any facts that support that.
The language of using your presence, I wrote a case called Smith a couple of years ago.
Right.
But it seems like those sorts of cases where presence is the aiding and abetting are cases where there's an active crime, like an assault and a burglary or a robbery or something, and the person's presence is being a strong arm or be standing in the way of people going to get help. I don't recall seeing any possession cases.
This is the first for me as well, Your Honor. I've never seen a possession case charged as aiding and abetting, and it's certainly disturbing to me because it's charged on very weak evidence here.
The argument at trial seemed to be more like their argument on count one.
That's right. I think you're completely correct there. It seems like it was an afterthought. It was an alternative theory. And, in fact, in the closing argument, the prosecutor couldn't even give any facts that would back up the aiding and abetting argument there. And as to Your Honor's Smith case, I am familiar with that case. This case, as you said, has no active participation to show the intending the presence was aiding. How
it all sort of conflates to the constructive joint possession
right.
argument, doesn't it?
That's right. I think that's what it really comes down to here, Your Honor.
But in terms of aiding and abetting, we do look at a number of different circumstances, including
right.
Presence at the scene of the crime. Obviously, she was there.
Correct.
A close association with the main offender. That was her boyfriend. And a lack of objection or surprise. And certainly she was not surprised.
No, but Your Honor,
quite the opposite. She knew
that's
exactly
right.
what was going on.
When you look at these cases, what you see a lot of times is testimony that the person who is in control of these drugs or the contraband is very nervous, sweating, fidgeting, that kind of thing. And what you have here is a person who's just very forthright. And
well,
who's not
well,
that
but
person.
Your inference is that she was forthright because she really didn't want to have anything to do with it. Isn't a reasonable inference that she was forthright is because they got caught red-handed?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And
why not? I mean, they were looking for him. They found him.
If you're on
with him, she knew that they were looking for him, and the police were being
called. She could have easily pinned it on him then.
Well, she did, didn't she?
If that's the case.
She said the drugs aren't mine, right?
She didn't say the drugs aren't mine. She just said they took out the bag, and they said, is there any weapons in here? And she said there was drugs, and she told them not a small amount. So she never took credit for those drugs. And she definitely could have said, if she was trying to push the blame off onto him, could have said, oh, they're his drugs, I had nothing to do with that. But that's not the case here. Here's a person who's taken totally by surprise, who's not involved in the possession of these drugs, who's just being as honest as she can at the time.
Well, she's not surprised if she knew the drugs were in there and knew a lot of drugs.
Taken by surprise by, I mean, the presence of the bounty hunters showing up right there.
But not, certainly not surprised by the drugs being there.
She knew of them, and we concede that, Your Honor.
What about on the last issue on the convictions? What is your recommendation there?
Your Honor, the state has conceded that issue, which I think they rightfully should do. If Your Honors do not reverse both convictions, we would ask for at least the aiding and abetting conviction to be reversed and vacated, and because there is a finding of guilt on count one, you are allowed to enter a conviction for count one.
Right, but the district court entered a conviction for count two, though.
Yes, and that was wrongly entered. If you are going to allow for both of those findings of guilt to stand, then only one conviction should stand.
Correct.
And that should be for count one and not count two. Are there any other questions from the court?
It appears not. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Respondent.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. And Your Honors, based on the questions that the court has presented so far to appellant, I will keep my argument brief. I would just like to point out three particular items. One, the standards that apply to this particular set of facts. And two, I'd like to clarify the record on a few points. It appears that as to count one, appellant's main arguments regard dominion and control over the substances. And as Your Honors have pointed out, the jointness part has also been clarified this morning. As to count two, the standard there regards both knowledge and intention that appellant's presence further the commission of that crime. So I'd like to clarify the record as to that. And finally, Your Honors, this court should affirm all but one conviction. The jury's guilty verdicts must remain intact, but because the district court sentenced as to count two and entered the verdict as to count two, it's the respondent's position that the conviction for count two should remain.
What are the circumstances that establish that the defendant appellant exercised dominion and control over the methamphetamine?
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to the joint constructive possession, the standard there is whether or not the circumstances prove show a strong probability that appellant exercised dominion and control over the drugs found in the bag. And as Your Honors have already pointed out, there's strong circumstantial factual evidence to connect and to tie appellant to the contraband found in the bag. Judge Reyes pointed out that appellant and her boyfriend at 2 in the morning were walking out with the bag together. We don't know who was holding the bag, but together they entered the vehicle at 2 o'clock in the morning. Appellant admitted at trial that she was in possession of the car on the night in question. She stipulated to that fact. Appellant was also found inside the Chevy Malibu with the methamphetamine. She had particular intimate knowledge about what was inside the bag, including the methamphetamine, and to know what is inside a zipped black bag shows intimate knowledge as well. And with regard to the act of exercising dominion and control, to put something in a bag is to conceal it, to put something either underneath, behind the driver's seat, inside, you know, where it's dark, that is exercising dominion and control to conceal it from others.
Is there any evidence that the appellant put the methamphetamine in the bag?
Either appellant or the driver, her boyfriend, Mr. Stone, could do that.
Right.
And still meet this standard of joint constructive possession, that there was a strong probability that appellant did participate in putting the bag in the car. The strong probability is the standard there.
I don't think the strong probability language can water down the requirement of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We still have to look for whether there are alternative hypotheses that are reasonable, that are inconsistent with the appellant's guilt.
And, Your Honor, I do understand that.
We don't know who put it in the bag, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
We have no idea.
And when you put all of these circumstances proved in a bucket, the bucket's overflowing, such that there is a strong probability that ties appellant directly to the contraband.
Right, but that's one reasonable hypothesis. Why isn't it reasonable to say that she was basically just along for the ride?
Your Honor,
literally and figuratively.
I can't point to a particular one fact that really seals the deal. You have to look collectively at what is the strong probability that appellant is tied sufficiently to the bag of methamphetamine. And we already have established knowledge. Appellant does not contend that she didn't have any knowledge about the drugs in the car. We have the circumstances of getting into the car at the same time at 2 in the morning, easy access, appellant's relationship with the driver, with Mr. Stone. And in particular, there is case law to support where one or more individuals is hiding something. That is an act of dominion and control. They don't want people to see their methamphetamine in the car. That is reasonable. Coupled with the knowledge, proximity, relationship, there is no reasonable inference that appellant wasn't sufficiently connected to the drugs found in the back seat. That's respondent's position. In addition, it's not a small fact that appellant admitted possession of the car. That was her car that she was driving.
It was her father's car.
Correct.
Right.
In the same way that many people use frequently a car that may be owned by someone else, but that is the car they use frequently or every day, whatever the frequency is. That's not uncommon. But between the two of them, she admitted possession of this car. In addition, the other factual piece I'd like to point out with regard to dominion and control. Appellant points out that the cell phone found in the bag was Stone's. And although appellant said initially, oh, yes, that's my boyfriend's phone, but can I please have it? That's not a small fact to ignore here. Because when the bounty hunters initially detained Stone, they did a search of his person. On the search of his person, he had his own cell phone. And then the second cell phone found in the bag, appellant says, please, can I have the cell phone back? That's not a small fact to overlook. Again, that's another fact you put in the bucket, which results in strong probability.
Drug dealers often have more than one phone.
Well, listen.
If we can take judicial notice of anything, that seems like a thing we can take judicial notice of.
Of course, Your Honor, but I don't want the court to miss that fact. Stone clearly had his own phone, and appellant wanted that phone. And in addition, unless Your Honors have any other questions as to count one, I'd like to move on to the aiding and abetting standard and point out that to prove aiding and abetting here and to sustain that conviction, this court has to examine the amount of knowledge that appellant had with regard to the activities going on with the contraband. And again, appellant essentially concedes that point. Everyone knows appellant knew about the drugs, the meth in her car. The second is this court has to find that the record is clear on appellant's intention that her presence and actions further the commission of that crime. And Judge Reyes went through the list himself earlier this morning during appellant's argument. So it's clear that appellant was playing a knowing role that the drugs were in her car.
But knowing, that I'm unfamiliar with any cases where just knowing that someone has something constitutes aiding and abetting the possession of that something. I know Judge Reyes' computer is right there. It's in proximity to me. As a presiding judge, this is kind of like my car right now. Am I aiding and abetting his possession of that computer?
Your Honor, The second part of analyzing aiding and abetting is whether or not the person tried to thwart the crime or tried to actively pursue it. And being a passive bystander, as the case law says, is not sufficient to aiding and abetting. But again, if you look at the circumstances proved and you look at that bucket of facts that is full, it's clear that appellant was a part of whatever criminal activity of possessing the contraband was. And in particular,
that's where I think it gets a little mixed up. If she was constructively jointly possessing it, I totally understand that. Mm-hmm. But if she wasn't constructively jointly possessing it and he was the only one possessing it, how could she aid and abet his possession just by being there?
And, Your Honor, there's more facts than just appellant being there. In addition, it's clear that there was some agreement that Stone was allowed to use appellant's car at 2 in the morning to go together with this bag of drugs, to be together with a bag of drugs. In addition, there's a close association between the two of them, a romantic relationship. And I'd like to point out one particular thing.
Those are the same factors we would use to conclude that they were jointly possessing the drugs.
Correct. The facts are intimately related between counts 1 and 2. But in particular, I'd like to point out that appellant says that because she was forthright that there was meth in her car, that somehow negates her responsibility and makes her not guilty of aiding and abetting. But I'd like to point out that she only disclosed these things after the fact. So she clearly had all the knowledge, the relationship, the timing, proximity, all of that up until the point that she was detained. And that is not sufficient to support a reasonable inference of innocence here. It was after she was caught and discussing the drugs in the car. There's no way that that could be viewed as thwarting the crime. It was after the fact. And the other point I'd like to point out is the Slifka case. The Slifka case is, it wasn't a driving while intoxicated, it was an open container case, where you have a driver, an open container between the driver and the passenger, and a passenger. And in that particular case, the issue was pulled over, open container in the middle, and because there was an open container, the police expanded the search in the car to look for other contraband of an open container driving while intoxicated and ended up finding marijuana in the front seat passenger compartment. So the issue was whether or not the police had probable cause at that particular moment to arrest the passenger for constructive possession of the marijuana found in the passenger front compartment area of the car. The passenger obviously didn't own the vehicle, didn't have anything to do with the vehicle, just a passive passenger in that particular circumstance. So that's one difference between the Slifka case and the case we have here. But the other thing is, it's true that appellant wasn't arrested at the time that she was detained. There was subsequent investigation, and between the circumstances proved, which indicate everything up until the detainment, and the subsequent investigation, which is looking into who owns the car, what's going on with the drugs, how much is it, what is it actually consisting of, a mixture, mostly methamphetamine. Between all of that together indicates that beyond a reasonable doubt, this appellant both aided and abetted and also jointly constructively possessed the methamphetamine that was found in her car. And, Your Honors, we ask that this court affirm all the convictions except count 1, and simply for the fact that the court entered a conviction on count 2 and also sentenced on count 2. So,
isn't the idea of aiding and abetting in this type of situation odd, kind of a little unusual? I mean, I get the first count, why that one was brought, but why count 2?
Your Honor, I didn't charge this case. I don't know.
Oh, but you're defending the conviction.
But to be frank, Your Honor, I don't have an answer for you on that. But unless the court has any questions, again.
Why would we? Did you say we should vacate the conviction on count 1? You agree there can't be 2 convictions?
Yes, Your Honor. I do agree that there cannot be 2 convictions.
If we were to say the evidence was sufficient, I feel like that we would allow the conviction to stand on count one and not on count two, but maybe I'm missing something.
Your Honor, essentially, it's the state's position that the jury's convictions on both should remain, only one conviction should remain, and the sentence should remain as is. And the sentence is on count two. That's the only reason I bring that up. Otherwise, it's up to the court's discretion, but at least one conviction must remain. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Your Honors, I only have a few points to make on rebuttal, and I'm happy to take any questions that you have. I'd just like to point out that there was no evidence that Ms. Vang put the drugs in the bag, carried them to the car, put them in the car. Other than her knowing about it, there's no evidence that she participated in any way in packaging the drugs or any other sort of dominion and control over these drugs.
But the drugs were brought from the building into the car.
That's right.
And she was one of the two people.
We have no evidence, Your Honor, regarding who brought the drugs, and there's, in this case, a lot of lack of evidence, but that is one of the areas that lacks evidence here.
Do we know if the drugs were brought to the car at that in the middle of the night or if they were already in the car?
We don't know,
because
Your Honor.
Because the bounty hunter was just worried about getting the other guy.
That's right. We do not know. It may be because it was dark they couldn't see. I have no answer for you, Your Honor.
It's not part of the circumstances proof.
That's right. Correct. Thank you, Your Honor. regarding the driver, the permissive inference that the driver or the person in control has possession, that is not dispositive here, Your Honors. Ms. Vang was neither in control of the car, and she was not the driver here. Mr. Stone was. He's the person who's in control. It's almost like these DWI cases where we see with actual physical control where someone is passed out behind a car but the engine's running and the keys are still there and they're found to be in control. He's the person who's in control in these circumstances. He's the person who's the driver. That's why that permissive inference is not dispositive to her situation.
But that seems actually to go to the second count of aiding and abetting, that she's allowing him to drive her car.
Yes, but again, she would have to use her presence in the car to aid his possession.
But why doesn't her letting him use the car go beyond mere presence?
Because McCook, Milton, everything that has come down from the Supreme Court and this court on aiding and abetting puts more action on her, that she has to intend her presence committing that crime, which is in the car,
help. But I mean, her presence, I think it would be a different situation if he said, can I take your car? I have to go run an errand. She has no knowledge of what's going on, what he's doing, and why he's doing it. Seems like a different situation than here, where not only is she allowing him to take her car, but her presence is there. She's actually there, present.
But she's not using her presence to help him. She's not driving him.
That's what I don't get, because her presence does seem to be there to facilitate whatever crime he's going to be committing.
It's like Judge Rodenberg was saying earlier with regard to aiding and abetting. You need to be taking more of an active role, such as the getaway driver, such as the person who is who's seen hiding the drugs underneath the car, or have paraphernalia on your person. Something else.
But I think you're pointing to evidence that's lacking, and we need to look at the evidence that's here.
Because
the fact that, yeah.
There's not a lot of evidence here, and that's why I point to that.
Right, but at the same time, I do think it's significant that they're leaving at 2 a.m. in the morning. It's not like there's a lot of places you can go at 2 a.m. in the morning, and her presence with him there in her car with drugs that she knows of seems to be a pretty strong indication that she knows that this isn't just, we're not going out to grab a bite to eat or visit some friends.
I'm going to point out to Your Honor that you keep repeating the word knows. And of course we've conceded that she knew. This goes beyond the proof here that the state has to show. It has to go beyond knowledge. And we do not have more than knowledge. We have proximity. We have knowledge. We do not have dominion and control.
Right, but we can also look at reasonable inferences from those.
So and the reasonable inferences don't lead up to a chain of events that would say that there's not a reasonable hypothesis of innocence.
You almost said no's there.
I almost said it was. No.
No, it's not. Don't fall into my trap.
You caught me. If there are no other questions from this panel, I would ask for a reversal.
Looks like we have none. Thank you. We thank both of counsel for your briefing and argument. We'll issue our decision within 90 days.